Hey everyone, before a show, here's our weekly LA Dodgers RBI report for the four, five, and six spots. So we have Teoscar Hernandez, number 9 in the league in RBI, Will Smith, number 16, and Max Muncy, number 38. And just to add a little more context here, the 1-2-3 hitters, Mookie Betts, Shohei Ohtani, and Freddie Freeman are all three of them are in the top 10 in on-base percentage. So they're getting on base a lot, but right now, four, five, and six hitters aren't driving them in a lot. So the opportunities are there, and we'll see as the season goes on if the four, five, and six hitters start to cash in more on those opportunities. The inspiration for this episode is thanks to a listener, David R. Thanks, David, for suggesting this. It was fun to research and put together. And for other listeners, if you enjoy the show, I appreciate any reviews and ratings on iTunes or whatever platform you use. Okay, here's the show. Over the last 100 years, there have been many showdowns in sports. Competition itself is integral to any sporting event. But there's something both universal and deeply personal about one-on-one. And over the course of this timeline, there are few events more exciting than the head-to-head home run race. When I say home run race, I'm referring to two men battling to break one of the most heralded records in baseball. Tonight, I'm going to look at three of the biggest races in history, the stories behind them, and not only how high some of these players climbed, but how far they fell afterwards. And if, for them, it was worth it in the end. You're listening to the Midnight Library of Baseball, where there are no loud noises, no jarring music, only nostalgic, thought-provoking, emotional stories about baseball. I'm Ben Orlando. I think the home run race has so much significance because it's so American, and it parallels the path and change of the country in the 20th century. By 1900, the United States was solid as a nation, coming into its own as a manufacturing giant. It was healing from the Civil War and starting to meddle in world affairs like the Spanish-American War in 1898. The country was prospering, innovating, growing, but after World War I, 20 years later, it was a manufacturing, economic, and global powerhouse. And not only was the country changing, but the perception of the country was changing. A similar story played out in baseball. So, what better place to begin our story than 1927 and the home run race between Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig? But really, when we're tracking the parallels between baseball and America, we should start in 1920. When Babe Ruth was smashing long balls in the 1920s, the home run was barely a thing. Remember, the major leagues was stuck in the dead ball era for the first 20 years of the 20th century, which meant low runs and few home runs. Because ballparks were so big, there wasn't much use trying to hit the ball out. So teams focused on a style of play called small ball, where managers encouraged bunts, stealing bases, slapping the ball for hits, and generating runs with strategy, one out at a time. Also contributing to the style of play was the baseball itself. The same ball might be used for an entire game, meaning it took a beating and lost its spring. Also, the ball got dirtier and dirtier with general use, and because of spitballs, so it was hard to see and hard to smash for long-distance drives. Babe Ruth came along at a time after Ray Chapman died from getting hit in the head with a spitball. The spitball was banned, and the ball became livelier and was replaced much more often. So a new era of baseball and a new type of ball player coincided with a nation stretching its legs and flexing its muscles for all the world to see. Now, when Babe Ruth hit 54 home runs in 1920, it must have been a euphoric time in not only baseball history, but American history. World War I came to a halt in 1918, and the Treaty of Versailles, officially ending the war, took effect in January of 1920. It was a time for celebration, for progress and change. 1919 saw the right to vote for women, and January 17th, 1920 saw the start of prohibition, a banning of alcohol across the country. And now you have this great duality. On one hand, America is this pious, pure, sober nation. And on the other hand, not really. Because you have millions and millions of Americans still drinking and snubbing their noses at this new law and authority. This is the time of bootlegging and underground speakeasies. As a decade, the 1920s are known as the Roaring Twenties. And who better to exemplify that roar than George Herman Ruth, known as the Babe, whose wild lifestyle and middle finger to authority was matched by his larger-than-life exploits on the baseball field. In 1920, Babe Ruth's 54 home runs would have been one of the loudest roars in baseball up to that time, as would his 59 home runs the following year. And just to add some context on how big a deal this would have been after 1900, the most home runs prior to Ruth, outside of Ruth himself in 1919 with 29, was Gavvy Kravath in 1915 with 24 home runs. But that number of 24 was really an outlier, because most years between 1900 and 1920, the home run leader was closer to 8 or 9 for the season. And all of a sudden, you have this strangely shaped man doing something that, frankly, no one knew was possible. To put this in perspective, today, if someone were to match this jump in home runs, it would be like, say, Mike Trout or Shohei Ohtani hitting 164 home runs. Let me repeat that. 164 home runs. Because percentage-wise, with Barry Bonds' 73 home runs, matching Gavvy Kravath's 24, that 164 number is equivalent to Ruth's unbelievable leap from 24 to 54. And in 1920, Ruth only played in 142 games. Considering he often had multi-home run games, he easily could have reached and surpassed 60 that year. And just to note, in Babe Ruth's time, the season was set at 154 games and didn't expand to 162 games until 1961, which is very important and will factor into our next home run race. And yes, after the dead ball era, players were hitting more home runs, but Babe Ruth was otherworldly in the numbers he put up. In 1920, and pretty much throughout the decade, Ruth consistently hit more home runs than entire teams. From the New York American in 1920, quote, "The crowd went quite mad. They had witnessed something no other people had ever seen before. Perhaps no one now living will ever see such a thing again," end quote. From writer Jacob Pomeranke, quote, "In 1920, the Sultan of Swat stormed past nearly every power-hitting record that baseball writers could dig up, and even a few that hadn't been invented yet. But before anyone had time to put Ruth's performance into historical context, he spent the 1921 season rewriting the record books all over again. Almost a century later, Ruth's 1920 and 1921 seasons remain as impressive as ever, and they are considered by many to be the most dominant back-to-back seasons in baseball history," end quote. And here's a great line from Cleveland Indians catcher Chet Pinch Thomas in an interview with Baseball Magazine in 1920. Quote, "I wish someone would describe to me just the kind of batter coming along in 1940 or maybe 1999 who will take Babe Ruth's record away from him. If it ever happens, he will be some freak. It would take a man 7 feet tall, weighing 300 pounds, and able to lift a piano with either hand to drive a baseball any further than Babe Ruth can drive it." End quote. It's kind of funny thinking about Chet Thomas's description of this behemoth here and what Mark McGwire actually looked like in all his muscular glory in 1998. But we'll get back to that. Until 1927, outside of Ruth, no one hit more than 42 home runs. And the man to do it in 1927 was Lou Gehrig. There's so many interesting facets to the 1927 home run race, but probably the most interesting is the juxtaposition of the two men involved, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. Ruth had been playing a number of years when Gehrig entered the league as a rookie in 1923. Ruth called him kid, because Ruth called lots of people kid, because Ruth was very bad at remembering people's names. From writer Tara Krieger, quote, "Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig were studying contrasts, one craving the spotlight, one hiding from it, one hedonistic, one almost puritanical. As much as Ruth's exploits were exaggerated, Gehrig's were understated. Ruth stayed out on all-night benders, losing track of how many hot dogs and women he'd had. Gehrig made sure to get 10 hours of sleep a night, was said not to touch alcohol or cigarettes, and couldn't string two sentences together in front of a woman who wasn't his mother." End quote. Both Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig were of German descent, but Ruth's parents died by the time he was a major league ballplayer, while Gehrig lived with his parents until he was 30. And he had that close relationship with his mother. But Babe Ruth also grew close to the Gehrigs. He was able to speak German with them, and Lou's parents eventually made up a room for Ruth's daughter because they visited so often. But on the field, season after season, Ruth continued to overshadow Gehrig, because even when Gehrig was doing great things, the press didn't want to write about him. And this was the vibe leading up to the 1927 home run race. According to journalist Paul Gallico, quote, "Gehrig, of course, cannot approach Ruth as a showman and an eccentric. Ruth is either planning to cut loose, is cutting loose, or is repenting the last time he cut loose. He is a news story on legs looking for a place to happen." End quote. And from Lou Gehrig himself, quote, "Let's face it, I'm not a headline guy. I always knew that as long as I was following the Babe to the plate, I could have gone up there and stood on my head. No one would have noticed the difference. When the Babe was through swinging, whether he hit or fanned, nobody paid any attention to the next hitter. They all were talking about what the Babe had done." End quote. In 1926, Lou Gehrig played only his second full season, and it was a good one. And I'm going to use the same inaccurate statistics that I've talked about before, just so people can relate. In 1926, Gehrig had a .316 batting average, drove in more than 100 runs, and led the league in triples with 20. But his season paled in comparisons to the Bambinos. In 1926, Ruth led the league in virtually every offensive category. Runs, home runs, RBIs, walks, slugging percentage, on-base percentage. And his batting average of .372, while not leading the league, was still hugely impressive. Ruth and Gehrig and the Yankees went to the World Series in 1926, taking the series all the way to Game 7 against the St. Louis Cardinals. And what happened in Game 7 highlights the larger-than-life character and perhaps inflated ego of Babe Ruth. Because with the Cardinals up 3-2 in the bottom of the ninth with two outs and Bob Mutual at the plate, and Lou Gehrig on deck, Babe Ruth, standing on first base, decided to try to steal second. Just to recap, it was the bottom of the ninth of Game 7, the series tied, and the Cardinals up by only one run, with two outs. And Babe Ruth had a total of 11 stolen bases that whole year, with only a 50% success rate. I mean, the whole Game 7 is a trip, for so many different reasons. Because in the sixth inning, Cardinals manager Rogers Hornsby replaced the starting pitcher, Jesse Hayns, with Grover Cleveland Alexander, who just pitched a complete game the day before and was rumored to have been out drinking all night. So it's two outs in the bottom of the ninth, Alexander on the mound, having pitched 13 innings over 2 days. And you have Bob Mujal at the plate, who hit 315 during the season and already had a double and triple off Alexander the previous game. And again, in the on-deck circle, you have Lou Gehrig, who was hitting 348 throughout the World Series. And what happens? Babe Ruth tries to steal second base and fails. And that's it. The game's over. The only time in World Series history that a game and or series ends with a runner thrown out. But that's Babe Ruth. For the 1927 season, the home run race season, we have more drama, as Ruth reported late for spring training. He was demanding $150,000 per year after already leading the majors the previous five seasons with the highest salary of $52,000. Ruth was performing in films, vaudeville shows, and doing everything but playing baseball. And he eventually settled for $70,000 over the next 3 years, equivalent to $1.25 million per year today. Compare this to Lou Gehrig, who showed up early to spring training after hearing a rumor he might be replaced, and settling for a salary of $8,000. So that's $70,000 for Ruth, $8,000 for Gehrig. But as the season began and Ruth started slow, Lou Gehrig took off, often leading in home runs week after week. On September 5th, the last month of the season, Gehrig and Ruth were tied with 44 home runs apiece. Then something happened to completely change the trajectory. Lou Gehrig's mother got sick, as she was rushed to the hospital with an inflamed goiter. Gehrig told journalists, quote, "I'm so worried about Mom that I can't see straight. If I lost her, I don't know what I'd do," end quote. Gehrig would hit only three more home runs, ending the season with 47, while Babe Ruth hit 16 over the next 24 games, including two in the third last game and his 60th in the second last game. After the game, Ruth said, quote, "60, count 'em, 60. Let's see some other son of a bitch top that," end quote. And emblematic of the Ruth-Gehrig relationship, Lou Gehrig ended up hitting his final home run on the last day of the season, but nobody cared. Ruth's 60 home runs in 1927 were more than the total of any other team in the American League, except for Ruth's teammates. But while Ruth broke the home run record, Lou Gehrig broke the RBI record in 1927 with 173. And what's equally mind-boggling to consider is that since Ruth hit 60 home runs and he batted before Gehrig, he emptied the bases 60 times before Gehrig stepped to the plate. And Gehrig still drove in 173 men. Ruth, by the way, drove in 165 men that year. But this combo would not be the highest RBI duo total in history. Ruth and Gehrig would top that in 1931, when Gehrig hit 185 RBI and Ruth hit 162. And for the highest single season total for home runs by teammates, Gehrig and Ruth come in third in history. The number one spot goes to the next home run race between Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris in 1961. It's hard to peg the United States as any one thing in 1961. You still have the economic boom a decade plus after World War II. You have the Cold War with the United States and Russia, or the USSR. You have the Civil Rights Movement. And you have John F. Kennedy elected president and calling out for major social change. In the 1960s, baseball is still America's sport. Mickey Mantle was 29 years old in 1961 and had been with the Yankees for 10 seasons, while 26-year-old Roger Maris had just come to the Yankees from Kansas City the year before and had been playing in the majors since 1957. But unlike the polar opposites of Ruth and Gehrig, Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris were both more like Lou Gehrig, at least in temperament. Teammate Whitey Ford said Mickey Mantle was, quote, a humble man who was kind and friendly to all his teammates, even the rawest rookie. He was idolized by all the other players, end quote. Mantle was a baseball prodigy, playing semi-pro ball at the age of 15 and joining the Yankees at the age of 19. Right away, he was given the number 6 because Ruth had the number 3, Gehrig had number 4, and Joe DiMaggio had number 5. And even though Mantle did well in spring training, it was just too much pressure for a 19-year-old kid, and he performed poorly and was sent down to the minors. Now, my memory of Mickey Mantle is of a tough, strong player who crushed mammoth home runs. And this is true. But he was also human, like everyone else. As a 19-year-old, Mantle struggled on the AAA team and ended up calling his father with his troubles. He said he couldn't take the failure and loneliness anymore and wanted to come home. According to writer James Lincoln Ray, Mickey's father, a man named Mutt Mantle, drove down to Kansas City and verbally thrashed his son, telling him, quote, now you shut up. I don't want to hear your whining. I thought I raised a man, not a coward, end quote. Mickey later said that when he listened to his father shouting, it was, quote, as though Mutt had leveled a double-barreled shotgun at my head, end quote. In that hotel room, young Mickey Mantle broke down in tears and told his father he'd give it another try. And he did well after that, really never looked back, returning to the Yankees by the end of the season. Now, a lot of people who know the story of Roger Maris know he had a tough time in New York. But New York was a tough town for Mantle, too. According to journalist George Vesey, quote, the fans had finally taken to Mantle after booing his butt for 5, 6, 7 years, end quote. Roger Maris didn't have that kind of time. He was an outsider in 1960 and 1961, and he was quieter, more inward-facing than Mantle. Roger Maris only cared about winning and helping his team, and the pursuit of singular records didn't interest him. Now, just for a second, I wanted to touch on a commonality between the 1927 Yankees and the 1961 Yankees, because it seems too rare to overlook, and possibly could have had some influence over what eventually happened in each season. So, I already talked about the 1926 season, where the Yankees lost in Game 7 of the World Series to the Cardinals, in the bottom of the ninth. Well, in 1960, a year before the Mantle-Maris home run race, the Yankees again lost the World Series, and again lost in dramatic fashion in the ninth inning of Game 7. So, kind of strange. And could these really hard losses have affected each individual player to light a fire under them the following year? Because at least Mickey Mantle was devastated after the loss. From Mantle, quote, there's a sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. I'm slumped in a stool, feeling so low that I can hardly peel off my uniform. In all of my World Series experience, that was the only time when I really thought the better team had lost, end quote. So there's that, and to me, there's also the strange anticipation of a home run race at the start of the 61 season. According to writer Phil Sheridan in an article for the History Channel, quote, the double pursuit of Ruth was a preseason storyline, and the intensity of the chase built by the end of June, when Maris and Mantle were ahead of the Bambino's 1927 pace. Then the pressure really ratcheted up that sizzling summer, end quote. When Sheridan said double pursuit, he's referring to both Mantle and Maris pursuing the record. And although Mantle had already won 4 home run titles, Maris wasn't a big home run hitter. For the 1960 season, he did hit 39 home runs, but previously his highs were 28, 19, and 16. But apparently the media smelled something, because early in the 61 season, both players were ahead of Ruth's pace. And as the Yankees continued to win, as Mantle and Maris went back and forth, home run for home run, the media did its best to pit the two against each other. According to writer Bill Pruden, quote, while he and Mantle got along fine, they even lived together during the season, the media did everything they could to turn the chase into a rivalry that it was not. Not only was the most revered record in baseball being put in jeopardy, but it was being done so by an outsider, the new kid from the Midwest, who not only sought to unseat the iconic Ruth, but was also challenging the reigning king, fan, and press favorite, Mickey Mantle. End quote. By September, Roger Maris could hardly bear the scrutiny from the press. The endless, repetitive questions, the favoritism of Mantle, and the intrusions in the locker room were so frequent that there was almost nowhere Maris could find a moment of peace. And it wasn't as if Maris was necessarily rude. As biographer Robert Creamer wrote, quote, Maris spoke the literal truth, and that jarred and upset people expecting ritual responses to their questions. End quote. And you can imagine, with the pressure, being tired after 4 or 5 games in a row, and being asked the same question again and again, you might get short from time to time. But to the press, Roger Maris was already intruding on hallowed ground, not only by threatening Babe Ruth, but also Mickey Mantle. According to Robert Gorman, quote, some sports commentators began to unfairly label him as sullen, a whiner, and angry, end quote. And to add to this unbearable pressure, there was another factor that added fuel to the flames, the 1961 expansion. In 1961, two more teams were added to the American League, the Washington Senators and Los Angeles Angels. And to make sure the schedule matched that of the National League, they added 8 games to the American League season, so 154 turned into 162. And in July of 1961, the Commissioner of Baseball, Ford Frick, decreed that a home run record would only count if the player achieved the goal in the same number of games available to Babe Ruth. In other words, 154 games. Now, as Robert Gorman wrote, this move by Frick seemed a bit fishy. As Frick didn't consult anyone, and apparently you'd normally consult the records committee of the Baseball Writers Association, but Frick didn't do that. And according to Gorman, the commissioner had no authority to dictate at the time how records should be recorded and validated. And also, on a very important side note, Ford Frick had been a good friend of Babe Ruth's. According to Phil Sheridan, Frick was one of only a few people allowed in the hospital room when Ruth died in 1948. So, conflict of interest? Probably. But other people agreed with Frick, arguing that if anyone broke the record after 154 games, it wouldn't be legitimate. And there were other arguments at the time. From Robert Gorman, quote, some fans and reporters questioned the quality of American League pitching that season, believing expansion had weakened the available talent pool. Others contended that the ball was juiced or that bats were livelier. A few players from Ruth's era asserted that playing conditions and travel was harder back in their day. All of these highly dubious claims, primarily intended to preserve the legacy of Babe Ruth, greatly increased the tension on the M&M boys as they neared Ruth's 60-homer record. End quote. In mid-September, with Maris leading Mantle 56-53 home runs, Mantle suffered an injury and had to sit out. For Mantle, injuries would plague his career. But as I stated in an earlier episode, it wasn't so much the injuries as the alcoholism and drinking that cost Mantle a lot of playing time over the years. According to Mantle himself, quote, everybody tries to make the excuse that injuries shortened my career. Truth is, after I'd had a knee operation, the doctors would give me rehab work to do, but I wouldn't do it. I'd be out drinking. End quote. So Mantle missed some games and ended the season with 54 home runs. And again, if we do the what if Mantle hadn't been drinking so much, he might not have sat out and might have broken that record himself. But Roger Maris, in reality, kept hitting the ball out of the park. And as he grew closer to the record, his anxiety went through the roof. According to Bill Pruden, quote, he became increasingly short-tempered and distraught, often hiding in the training room to avoid the prying reporters with what he saw as their repetitious and often inane questions. Amidst the tension, Maris's hair fell out in clumps, and he had trouble sleeping, end quote. And from Yankee teammate Cleet Boyer, quote, it was only when Rogers started losing his hair that we understood what kind of pressure he was under, end quote. In game number 154, the final game of the old system, Roger Maris hit his 59th home run, becoming only the second player in history to do so. He hit his 60th home run in his 158th game. And on the last day of the season, Maris hit number 61 to give his Yankees a 1-0 win over the Red Sox. And this was in front of a fairly small crowd of 23,000 fans. Remember, the commissioner had already delegitimized any home runs after 154 games. And journalist George Vesey, who had been covering the Mantle-Maris race, wasn't even at the game. According to Phil Sheridan, quote, Vesey's newspaper decided a New York Titans football game at the Polo Grounds was the bigger story, end quote. And from Vesey, quote, somebody in the press box had a transistor radio. I remember hearing somebody say, he did it, end quote. Mickey Mantle played until 1968, but was constantly hampered by injuries and alcohol, and wouldn't come close again to his 1961 total of 54 home runs. When asked about the 1961 season, Roger Maris said, quote, as a ball player, I would be delighted to do it again. As an individual, I doubt if I could possibly go through it again, end quote. The Yankees went on to win the World Series that year, but Roger Maris was only able to relax when he was finally traded to the St. Louis Cardinals in 1967. There he found a supportive community of players and fans, where he could be encouraged for being a team player, and nothing more. Who knows if the stresses of his career, his record-breaking 1961 season, and time in New York had a permanent effect on his health. But Roger Maris died of cancer at the age of 51. And just a few side notes. Even though Maris tied Ruth's record in four extra games, he actually did it in fewer plate appearances, 684 to Ruth's 687. Also, Roger Maris held the home run record for more years than Ruth. For Ruth, it was 34 years. For Maris, it was 37. And this brings us to 1998, with the home run race of Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. But really, home runs start to jump into the 50s throughout the 1990s. And now, of course, we know of the doping scandals. In 1994, Matt Williams had 43 home runs, and Ken Griffey Jr. had 40 before the season was cut short by 50 games because of the strike. In 1995, Albert Bell hit 50 home runs. In 1996, Brady Anderson hit 50 home runs. Also in 1996, Mark McGwire hit 52 home runs in only 130 games. The next year, McGwire hit 58 and Ken Griffey Jr. hit 56. And there's no evidence that Griffey Jr. ever took steroids. So by 1998, everyone was watching. And because the 162-game season had been a thing for 37 years, people no longer made a big deal of it. If you broke the record during the season, you broke the record during the season. Now, Mark McGwire was no surprise in 1998, but it's interesting to look at his progression, because when people debate whether Griffey Jr. doped or not, they say that his numbers never jumped. But when you look at home run hitters, you often see erratic numbers. It was true for Babe Ruth, it was true for Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle, so that seems like a problematic measure. And it's important to note that during McGwire's first full season in 1987, inside a much smaller, leaner frame, he hit 49 home runs. Was he juicing at that point? I don't know. But his home run output remained mostly in the 20s and 30s until 1996. Sammy Sosa was more of a surprise, as he never had a huge season until 1998. For Sosa, it was 20s, 30s, and 40 in 1996. But before I turn to the players, I want to spend some time on the state of baseball in 1998, and the state of the country, and what this home run race meant to people. Again, this was a pretty good time in the United States economically. The crash is a decade away, and 9/11 is 3 years off. But for baseball, the 1990s was a time of decline. It had already been declining for the past few decades, trying to compete with other more fast-paced sports and hobbies. And the player strike in 1994 didn't help. But fans and players saw the home run race of 1998 exciting and revitalizing. According to Alexander Harriman, attendance from 1996 to 1998 rose by 10 million people. MLB player George Springer, who was 9 in 1998, said, quote, "There's an argument to say that's one of the best summers of baseball anybody has ever watched, because you were so locked into what those guys were doing," end quote. And from MLB player Evan Longoria, who was 12 at the time, quote, "I just remember thinking that baseball was at the top of its popularity. It was everywhere," end quote. The Maguire-Sosa race even impacted current professional ballplayer Dominic Smith, who was only 3 years old at the time. According to Smith, quote, "You don't remember too much, but I remember the excitement of my family, my uncles, my dad, and seeing them react to seeing something that amazing. It seemed like they almost hit a home run every night. One hit one, the next one hit two. It really brought an energy and buzz back to the game of baseball, which had left it for a bit," end quote. According to journalist Gabe Lackeys, quote, "The popular narrative then was that Maguire and Sosa saved baseball, as the sport was flagging just 3 years after a lengthy player strike and lockout canceled the 1994 World Series and stretched into the 95 season," end quote. At the start of the 98 season, the buzz was about Mark Maguire and a different player, Ken Griffey Jr. And rightly so. Griffey Jr. had 56 home runs the year before and 49 the year before that. And he'd go on to finish the 1998 season with 56 home runs. That year, Greg Vaughn also hit 50 home runs and Albert Bell hit 49. But as the season wore on, it became clear that the race to break Roger Maris's 61 record was between two men, 34-year-old Mark Maguire and 29-year-old Sammy Sosa. When we look at the dynamics between Maguire and Sosa, we see a different set of personalities from what we'd seen before with Ruth, Gehrig, Mantle, and Maris. Maguire was friendly but serious. He had a job to do, whereas Sammy Sosa was more of a gracious, happy-go-lucky guy. He exhibited some of the same clownish behavior as Babe Ruth, but none of the leading man vibes. According to ESPN columnist Tim Kuehn, Sosa's role was, quote, "the comic relief sidekick, assigned to play a simplistic stereotype in service of the man who was preordained to play the lead. He motivated himself by throwing open the door and inviting the world in." Sosa couldn't go more than three words without reminding everyone how much fun it was to do what he was doing. End quote. Mark Maguire, on the other hand, didn't seem to be having fun. Quite the opposite. In fact, as the season wore on, Maguire said he felt like a caged animal. From Tim Kuehn, who attended many of the games and had inside access, quote, "I stood in front of that locker after a game more than 20 times that season, and each time Maguire emanated a unique brand of pain. He deflected often, suggesting that we talk to his St. Louis Cardinals teammates, going so far as to point around the room and list their names and contributions, sounding like the world's most dour MC." Kuehn went on to say, quote, "In the 162-episode dramatic series that became the 98 season, that was Maguire's role, the brooding, team-first giant who just happened to possess a singular skill that he never seemed to embrace. He motivated himself by locking the door and pushing the world away," end quote. And as Kuehn went on to write, there was this massive paradox with Mark Maguire. when we consider the steroids. In an interview with Cuban that year, McGuire said, quote, "I think it's just a fascination with the home run and the power that's come about the last couple of years. People are shaking their heads thinking, what's going on here? They don't understand it," end quote. But as Cuban rightly pointed out, McGuire absolutely understood it. He was taking steroids, and that was part of this paradox. Here's this humble, quiet man who seems to want, above all things, to simply help his team and be left alone. And yet he goes to extraordinary lengths, or as Cuban puts it, extra legal lengths, to set himself apart, which in turn acts as a magnet to draw all the attention on him. And McGuire didn't just set himself apart through his ability, he physically set himself apart. In 1998, McGuire stood 6 feet 5 inches tall and weighed 250 pounds. In comparison, world bodybuilding champion and the original Incredible Hulk, Lou Ferrigno, stood 6'5 and weighed 285 pounds. So McGuire wanted to be invisible while literally standing out from every player on his team. On the other hand, McGuire isn't really hard to understand, because how many of us live in this paradox to some degree? See me, don't see me. Pay attention to me, please leave me alone. It's that child at the pool on the diving board shouting, "Look, mommy, look, mommy." But it's also that child taught to hide in the background, to disappear. That's Mark McGuire. But regardless of him feeling like a caged animal and all his hiding, McGuire continued to perform. And on September 8th, 1998, he hit home run number 62. Now remember, when Roger Maris broke the record in 1961, during a time when baseball was America's sport, there was a paltry crowd at Yankee Stadium, a little over 23,000 fans. For Mark McGuire, at Busch Stadium in St. Louis in 1998, 43,688 fans showed up to hopefully witness the extraordinary act. And in addition to all these fans, as fate would have it, the one other person in the world vying for the same achievement happened to be standing in the outfield, Sammy Sosa, because the Cardinals were playing the Cubs that day. To cap off a magical, amazing baseball season, when Mark McGuire hit the record-breaking home run, Sammy Sosa ran in from right field and embraced McGuire, giving him a big hug. Apparently, Sosa's teammates didn't like what he did. As Tim Kuhn wrote, quote, "Many of his Chicago Cubs teammates fumed at the break with decorum, but in the summer of 98, it was deemed best to shut up and let it ride." As a season, as an experience for the fans and their positive feedback toward the heroes, there's no question 1998 blows away 1961. But the aftermath for the season is a different story. Roger Maris, for years until his death, felt bitterness and anger about the way 1961 played out, and the unfair expectations placed upon him. In 1998, Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa were treated as heroes. In the end, McGuire destroyed Maris' record by knocking 70 home runs. And in any previous season over the past century, Sammy Sosa would have been heralded king, as he finished with 66 home runs. But not this year. Talk about bad timing. And even though Barry Bonds will go on to break McGuire's record in 2001 with 73 home runs, it's like the dam had already been broken. And when we take a step back, let's just look at some additional unbelievable numbers. Sammy Sosa hit 66 home runs in 1998. The next year, he hit 63, then 50, then 64. And in 1999, Mark McGuire hit 65 home runs. Barry Bonds, who hit 73 in 2001, never hit more than 49 home runs in any other season throughout his 22-year career. Overall, when we look at these three races, what happened before, during, and after, it seems like Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig fared the best. During and immediately after the race in 1998, McGuire and Sosa won, hands down, for their overall reception by the media and fan base, but they also paid for it in enormous ways. In 2020, Tim Kuhn wrote an article for ESPN on the 1998 home run race, as well as the aftermath. And he wrote, quote, "McGuire, after retreating from public view for several years after his retirement, gave a tearful public apology as a prelude to becoming a hitting coach for three big league teams. Sosa, whose thirst for attention wore on his teammates, has paid a higher price. He is not welcome at Cubs games or events, despite carrying the franchise for many of his 13 years with the team. If Sosa does not admit to PED use and apologize in a manner that suits current club ownership, he will continue to be shunned." End quote. In this article, Kuhn saw what happened to McGuire and Sosa as a major hypocrisy, because while it was happening, McGuire and Sosa generated millions upon millions of dollars for their teams and team owners, who were now shutting them out. And for one more telling example, the spot where McGuire hit his 70th home run was quickly transformed into suite number 70 and rented out for a revenue of $400,000 per year. If owners didn't outright know what was going on, they knew the general truth, and they chose to look the other way. As Kuhn put it, quote, "For a team owner, even one who entered the game after 1998, to demand contrition is laughable to the point of insult. For all the shadings and half-truths and outright lies of the steroid era, consensus can be found in the following five words: ignorance was incentivized and monetized." End quote. And I want to just highlight one more point regarding Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa. During this period in baseball, hundreds of players were using steroids or some kind of performance-enhancing drugs. But there were still only two players in baseball in 1998 to hit more than 60 home runs. As a mortal man, it's hard to look at these six men and feel sorry for them, considering the rewards of their accomplishments. But it's also fair to say most of them did not come out of the race unscathed. Babe Ruth evolved the home run from an occasional thrill to a staple of the game to the most thrilling, anticipated aspect of the game. And through their drug-induced abilities, Sammy Sosa and Mark McGuire produced an oversaturated, overstimulated version of this thrill, which led to a national hangover from which baseball fans might never recover. But can we just take a step back and enjoy the game itself? I'm thinking of Field of Dreams right now and Shoeless Joe Jackson and his teammates walking out of the cornfield. Ray Kinsella and Terrence Mann and Ray's family sit and enjoy these players. And all the while, there's this undercurrent of truth that these men cheated. They tainted the game. But they've paid their penance, and now they just want to play. When you break down the stories and lives of Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, Sammy Sosa, and Mark McGuire, you can find the same basic desire to play the game, play it well, and help their teammates win. So ultimately, they feel like they belong, like they're part of something. When you strip everything away, that's the underlying beauty and value of baseball. And that's the end of the show. I'd love to hear what you think about this topic, so please share your thoughts on Instagram, at Midnight Library of Baseball. You can also go to my website, midnightlibraryofbaseball.com. You can go to Facebook, or at the many platforms hosting a podcast. You can also send me an email at midnightlibraryofbaseball@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. And feel free to donate on Podbean or at my website. The music is A Long Way by Sergey Pavkin at Pixabay. Good night.